Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine, and you can listen to it on the website of The Nation, but it's also widely available in all the sort of platforms that carry podcasts. I should mention that the music at the beginning is from Micah Whitman, and we're very grateful for his contributions, which get us off to a good start every week. So this week, we got a sort of full panoply of American monsters on our TV screens through the debates at the first Republican presidential debate for 2024. Absent, of course, the biggest monster of all, Donald J. Trump, who is, first of all, as the front runner by a wide margin, doesn't feel himself compelled to debate these lesser lights, but is also undergoing a lot of legal problems as of his own. So to talk about this, the presidential debates and what it kind of says, I'm very happy to have on Chris Lehman. He's a fellow writer at The Nation, and he's written about the debates, and he's also recently written about the indictments of Donald Trump and where we are in terms of having a, you know, some sort of legal redress for Trump's many crimes against the Republic. Chris, I'm very happy to have you on. I mean, you know, Trump wasn't there, but he was also there. It's kind of like Schrodinger's Trump, or the Cheshire Trump. He, not on the debate stage, but a kind of looming, invisible presence. What were your impressions of the debate?
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, there were a number of narratives to sort of track during the melee that transpired in Milwaukee. One is obviously, you know, there's with Trump's lead so commanding in the early polling, you know, everyone sort of described this as an aftercard event that, you know, these were people largely positioning either for, you know, greater traction in future presidential runs or, you know, the strangely coveted slot of being Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee. Given that Trump's last vice president, who was also on the stage, you know, ended his term in office receiving death threats choreographed by Trump, I'm not sure why, you know, people are falling over themselves to be Trump's vice presidential nominee, except it's the old narrative of, you know, people going after power by any means necessary. And also, I think deluding themselves, as everyone has throughout Donald Trump's career, thinking, well, I'll be the exception. I'll be the one who charms the monster and, you know, will win his favor and go on to still greater things. You can ask Michael Cohen how that line of thinking tends to pan out. And, you know, the four Trump attorneys who just turned themselves in Georgia. But in any event, I think, you know, the Republican Party is in this really bizarre plight that, you know, it freakishly came into power under Donald Trump's leadership in 2016 due to a whole series of, I think, pretty random and unrepeatable events. And now they're, you know, deadlocked in the grip of Trumpism, even though the last three election cycles have not gone their way. And that's conventionally the time when you hit the reset button if you're a major political party. And so, you know, in a way, the debate was really a scrum to see who could be the most palatable version of Donald Trump, given that Donald Trump may end up, you know, if not in an orange jumpsuit, you know, maybe disqualified from the presidency, certainly damaged by his legal troubles. And, you know, it was yet another reminder of how unrepeatable Donald Trump himself is. You know, there is no pat formula to kind of, you know, hit the right number of, you know, insults, drive-by attacks, and, you know, soliloquies about wind power or toilets not flushing properly. You know, these are all very sui generis kind of features of the Trump brand, the Trump political brand. So you had, you know, these kind of, you know, in my mind, both ludicrous and a little poignant efforts to impersonate Trump in a more palatable manner. You know, you had Ron DeSantis trying to be, you know, as cold and vicious a version of the Trump agenda. You know, he relished saying he would kill cartel members stone cold dead and invade Mexico his first day in office. You had, you know, Mike Pence in this, you know, kind of impossible position of having been the person who, you know, with legitimate honor faced down the January 6th coup and wanting kind of credit for that, but also saying, you know, he's incredibly proud of the Trump-Pence administration. You have, you know, Tim Scott trying to dress up the Trump message with, you know, full-scale attacks on the IRS, the Department of Education, teachers' unions. And it all is just comes across in this Mad Libs fashion. Like, you know, these are all, you know, random elements of a reactionary ideology that now runs the Republican Party. But without the kind of central, weirdly charismatic figure of Donald Trump, they just fall completely flat. And that's why all these candidates are trailing so badly in the polling. And we should also obviously mention Vivek Ramaswamy, who did the most impassioned kind of millennial Trump imitation, you know, just, you know, declaring he would wipe out the administrative state to court, create a revolution, and, you know, saying climate change was a hoax, all of this, you know, stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, I do think of the various Trump imitators, you know, Trump cover bands, we could call right. them. I do think that Ramaswamy sort of came the closest, and it's worth asking, like, you know, why he was able to do that. And it's partially, you know, he's never held elected office, so he's not right, bound by the kind right. of, you know, record and rules and conventions of sort of normal politics. He is a bit, I mean, I think Republican voters have shown a certain propensity to be attracted to the kind of abusive boss figure, the CEO, right. you know, the take charge CEO who will, like, fire everybody. And Trump had that to perfection because he played that character on The Apprentice. Television, right. so obviously he had the authenticity that you could only get from reality TV. but you know, Ramaswamy can do that with some degree of credibility. He is a CEO. I mean, I think his business model, like, as people will inspect it, seems a little bit crooked, but that's also true of Trump. I think that, and so he is able to come out. I am the political outsider. I'm not beholden to the donor class, as Trump claimed in 2015, 2016, I'm my own man, and I'm also, CEO. So I think that's a pretty attractive package. And I have to say, speaking as someone who's born in India himself, I think there's a kind. I was born in India. Vivek was obviously born in the United States, but he is of Indian heritage, and he falls into this sort of category of the sort of model minority that is willing to exploit his status as a person of color to ingratiate himself to Republicans who like nothing more than a person of color who says, reverse racism is the real racism. So altogether, none of these guys are going to overtake Trump. Some of them, will end up in his cabinet. One of them could end up as the vice presidential nominee. And I have to say, of the people on stage, I think Vivek Ramaswamy seems like he did the best Trump impersonation.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And there's also the generational millennial aspect of it, which he played up very aggressively. This idea that, as he chided Mike Pence, the Cold War ended in 1989. We need a new cohort of leaders. And it's interesting, it became really clear that, the other candidate of Indian American descent on the stage was Nikki Haley. And there's like this really palpable tension between those two rivals. And I think there's some weird anxiety of influence on Haley's part, like, this was supposed to be my slot, And Vivek is this, as you say, this kind of upstart kid who's, who relishes being attacked. It was very clear he was smiling as, everyone else clamored to go after him. And that's another, kind of little remarked feature of Trump's appeal. He's so associated with this dour kind of Spenglerian vision of,
American carnage.
American carnage, exactly. Everyone forgets that Trump is a textbook apostle of positive thinking. Norman Vincent Peale was his preacher, presided over his first wedding, and all the election denial stuff is pure Norman Vincent Peale. It is just like, you create a mental universe in which it's literally impossible for you to think about failing. And all of that comes from Trump, I think. And Ramaswamy is also that kind of weird, happy warrior, even though he wound up saying things like, we're in a very dark time. There's an internal cold civil war that we're living through. But he does it in this kind of like, it's a really difficult mindset to characterize because it's so contradictory.
Sure. I mean, it's a sort of very pessimistic about sort of public life and the state of the American project, but very hyper optimistic about one's the personal competence of this sort of CEO class,
Right.
And
I alone business. Can fix it.
Yeah. Sort of, since we started with Gramsci, like one can flip Gramsci's thing. It's a kind of, pessimism of the social order combined with an optimism of self-help ideology.
Right, exactly. It's a real, and it's such a deeply American thing. And that what's interesting about DeSantis is he, was hammering away at it. Every other sentence out of his mouth was like, America is in decline. And, he only offers like this, grim, punishment minded, he's going to kill the cartel lords in Mexico. He's going to, break the teachers unions. He it's like he's going down this checklist of enemies, and he has no, his affect is all just, grim, shouty, commands he's barking essentially, and it utterly fails to land with the Trump base, which is interesting because policy wise, he's, you know, it's like Trump on steroids. You know, it's doing all the culture war stuff. It's doing all of the kind of, you know, assaults on the deep state bureaucracy and getting none of the traction.
Yeah, no, I mean, it perhaps shows how little policy is actually, you know, behind this matter, and how much affect. And but also, like, I mean, I think that self-help, you know, positive thinking component is so strong. And it's interesting that some of the Trump imitators don't see that. I mean, you mentioned, right. you know, Ramaswamy smiling and the sort of happy warrior willing right. to, you know, take the arrows of his opponent and just mock them. You know, if compared to, like, you know, Ron DeSantis, it's actually painful to see this guy try to smile. If you can, you can easily find these the images on social media, but there was an attempt at a smile, and you know, like you felt like this is this robot is not achieving this AI is not achieving sentience.
Yeah, no, the operator's manual needs to be updated.
I do think obviously it's interesting that, like, so much of the attack was aimed at Vivek Ramaswamy because you would think that DeSantis, as the number two candidate, you know, he has the leader on that stage, would be the one that was under attack. But so clearly everyone kind of senses that Vivek is the guy with the energy, with the juice. He's the one, you know, you don't want to see rise. One would imagine that, you know, like, coming out of the debate, we're seeing, you know, sort of indications just based on sort of Google searches, but also some focus groups, you know, that Vivek did the best. And then Nikki Haley came in second. But if that's the case, like, he's going to get under more attacks. And, like, where do we think the attacks are going to come from?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there were, you know, lots of, you know, Mike Pence said something like, this is not the time for on the job training, you know, a lot of attacks on his experience, which, again, you know, it's exactly what everyone did to Trump in 2016. And it just did not matter.
Of course, because you have a voting base that, like, hates Washington, hates the established order, and actually hates the Republican Party. So to say, like, I'm a Republican governor with a record, and this businessman has no experience, like, you're slitting your own throat.
It's the Jeb Bush playbook. It's just like, yeah, we know where that leads in the Trump era. And it's also interesting, I was thinking about this, you know, when Ramaswamy first announced, I wrote a piece for The Nation about how he is touting, you know, the mistaken American version of the meritocratic ideal. Like, he's, you know, his whole assault on wokeism is predicated on this idea that, you know, merit is the ironclad and steadfast determinant of individual virtue, of success in the capitalist economy, all of which is discredited by almost the entirety of American history. And it's interesting because I was also thinking back in 2016, I wrote a couple columns about how Trump was the anti-meritocratic candidate. You know, he stood up in this field of, you know, sort of seasoned politicians and governors touting their records and said the entire system is corrupt. And I donated to Democrats because that's how the game is played. And, you know, this is how you get access in a totally corrupt system. He, you know, just gleefully toppled the whole ideology of meritocracy. And it's an interesting, again, this.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, desperate need to find a formula to replicate Trump on the right, you know, you just keep running into these kind of, you know, he has somehow, as you were saying, forged this bond with the Republican base so that they, you know, just basically reject everything about the conventional models of political leadership. You know, they don't want experts. They don't want, you know, IRS bureaucracies. They don't want the deep state. They don't want people cooperating across the aisle. They want to break things. And, you know, Ramaswamy definitely can break things, as you alluded to in his business career. It's all private equity, sort of pharmaceutical grift. But he still has this kind of residual attachment to the meritocratic dream in America that, you know, I don't know how that will play. It's a cudgel against the alleged forces of wokeness. But as you and I have both written, the great counter revolution against wokeness has not really yielded significant political turns on the right.
No, exactly. And I was actually kind of struck with the debate. There was some talk of wokeness, but not as much as
it was quite, you know, there were anti-trans things, you know, that people sort of did as asides, because that is something that all the Republicans feel comfortable with.
But not a lot. And I do think that, you know, they're kind of waking up to the fact that this is not the political winner that they
thought it was after Glenn Youngkin, right?
No. I mean, the whole meritocracy thing. I mean, it's interesting. There's such a distrust, and this goes beyond the Republican base, but it's particular in the strong in the Republican base of institutions, of like, you know, like these authority figures. But I think though, maybe among Republicans, the one place where they still kind of believe in meritocracy is money, right? Like if you're, right, you know, you're the figure that made the money, that shows that you know what you're doing more so than, you know, the eggheads, the experts, the
that's right.
Yeah. So and he has, you know, like Ramaswamy has a, you know, compelling sort of story for that base of, you know, right, like being a billionaire. You know, one can, you know, like I as with Trump, you can like look at that and say like, actually these businesses, you know, are kind of, you know, fraudulent or whatever. Shells, but to some degree, I mean, within the context of American capitalism, I don't think people care, or at least Republican voters don't care, like, you know, whether you made your money honestly or not. Or this is the party of used car dealers, right? Like, this is the party. So of car dealers in general. So I mean, you know, it's kind of accepted that you do have a little bit of blarney and a little bit of like salesmanship in order to like, you know, make the final sale, right? Like you have so I kind of I mean the contrast between Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley is interesting, because they're both you know, I think exploiting their status as a model minority, but to different factions of the party. Like I feel like to the extent that there is still this old Republican establishment, Nikki Haley is perhaps sewing that up and getting, you know, like she will maybe become the favorite candidate of the donor class. And, you know, like she has their policies in both sort of economics, you know, like complaining about government spending, and on foreign policy, saying like we have to, you know, stay in Ukraine, and that China's like the big enemy. So I sort of feel like, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I would not have predicted that, you know, that leaving Trump aside, the two kind of avatars of the two wings of the party would both be of, you know, South Asian descent.
Right.
It's, and I have to say, like, of the two wings, like, you know, like the donor class can get you money and some attention and a lot of favorable media coverage, but are they going to get you? I think that the sort of MAGA base that distrusts all this, that, you know, like isn't sure, you know, like why are we spending money on Ukraine when we could be killing Mexicans?
Right, exactly.
You know,
bring the war back home. Yeah.
So, I just think, like, yeah, I mean, I'd like you maybe get your thoughts on this, but I feel like of the two, if these are the two emerging figures, like, I feel that Ramaswamy, you know, has an edge over Haley, not with the donor class, but with the GOP masses.
Yeah, no, I think he definitely represents the future of Trumpism, you know, or a figure like him. And he's clearly, you know, adapting very rapidly to, like, you know, the profound shifts in our politics. I was also thinking when you were describing, you know, the kind of grift-like character of both his and Trump's fortune, I remember when The Apprentice first aired, some critic, you know, wrote about the, you know, there were many scenes in the penthouse apartment of Trump Tower where Trump lives. And, you know, it's like a gilded bathroom, a gold toilet. It's some TV critic wrote at the time that Donald Trump is a poor person's model of a rich person. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is, you know, God knows how much ink has been spilled about, you know, the somewhat mythical, you know, attraction of Trump to the white working class. But I do think that kind of brash and unapologetic embrace of wealth, as the metric of, you know, success and achievement is very, it's kind of the original DNA of the Republican Party going back, you know, to its 19th century roots. And I think, you know, Ramaswamy understands the kind of faux populist appeal of, you know, trashing the administrative state, of saying, you know, that these are doomed wars that we're once again going into, and Ukraine is just like Vietnam or Iraq. That is going to really play, I think, with the MAGA base. The other thing I always say about the present condition of American politics is that the Republican Party is afraid of its base and the Democratic Party hates its base. And so you have very different dynamics, you know, in the scrum for party leadership in both parties as a result. And, you know, the trick for, you know, aspiring Republican leaders is, again, to do the unrepeatable Trump thing of sort of get the base riled up about, you know, whatever it is, you know, the, you know, Colin Kaepernick one week and then, you know, China and COVID the next. It's, you know, always a moving target. And then just do nothing to, you know, these aren't really solvable problems anyway that they're all gesturing toward. And you know, that part Ramaswamy has down. Like it's obvious he's not going to, if he were somehow to be elected president, he wouldn't be able to dismantle the federal workforce overnight and, you know, do all of these things. But, you know, it makes great, you know, pseudo populist theater to say you're going to do all that. And it gets that the base, you know, riled up in the way that Trump knows how to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Like, I mean, Trump's own presidency shows the model of this, that, you know, there are real limits as to what Republican president could do, even, you know, during the brief period where, like, Trump enjoyed a trifecta. But I mean, in some ways, the two sides feed on each other. It's precisely the gridlock of the political system that is really unable, like, you know, under Democrats or Republicans, to, you know, seriously address any, you know, major problem that, like, problem. Makes it so appealing to, like, you know, well, at least we can have entertainment, right? Like,
right, you know, and also, like, you know, you can have the kind of, you know, fulfillment wish of, like, burning it all down, you know.
Send
the IRS packing, send the teachers unions packing, you know. We'll have whatever a Calvin Coolidge like, you know, government once again. You know, it's so hilarious to me where, you know, Mike Pence was simultaneously touting, you know, what were toward the end of the Trump years, you know, low unemployment, you know, historic low unemployment for women, for African Americans and Hispanic workers, and never virtually the same breath denouncing rampant government spending when all of the sort of economic gains that Trump was able to realize occurred through massive deficit spending, like, you know, not only during the COVID emergency, which was a, you know, a weird reversion to an American welfare state that the Republican Party, you know, reviles in theory, but also the massive tax cuts enacted in 2017. You know, that was already a historic level of deficit spending, and then you had COVID on top of that. And so Mike Pence is now going to run around and say, you know, Joe Biden is spending like a drunken sailor. Like, yeah, again, policy just does not matter.
Although I will say, like, I think one thing where, like, the Republican Trump wannabes, I mean, it seems that they are different or they're failing, is there is a reversion to the old sort of, you know, Paul Ryan, you know, like, we got, you know, deficits too high, we gotta start, you know, tightening the belt. And Trump doesn't talk like that. Like, and then Trump is like, you know, it looks like, I mean, his most recent policy statement, which is like, you know, like a 10% tariff, dubious on its own right, but it kind of, you know, he doesn't talk about cutting Social Security or Medicare. So, I mean, again, I think that gives him an edge, against people who, like, give all the evidence of still being so beholden to the donor class that they will, advocate wildly unpopular policies. What the plutocrats want to hear. Since we're talking about Trump, I mean, do you want to just maybe round this out with, you know, like, where you think the indictment stands? I've always felt that the Georgia case was the most serious. You know, obviously the Jack Smith stuff with January 6th is also important, but I mean, I thought the Georgia case seemed to give, like, the most is the richest sort of target area in terms of having, like, the most like evidence of, like, you know, like, just how Trump's operation worked. And in your column, you kind of talked about it, that it is this kind of a criminal enterprise. And I don't think it's an accident that, you know, they used the sort of RICO laws that one would normally, you know, bring to bear upon mafiosos on this. What's your impression of the case that's now being brought against them?
Yeah, no, I think a number of things are striking when you sort of lay the Georgia indictment alongside the Jack Smith January 6th indictment. First of all, in Jack Smith's indictment, Donald Trump is the only person named. In the Georgia indictment, there are 18 other charged co-conspirators who have already started to turn themselves in against the deadline for the defendants to turn themselves in and be arraigned is tomorrow. And Trump is, I think, in the process of appearing for what is now his third criminal arraignment as we speak. So the other thing that's worth noting, you know, I mean, there's a whole theory that the main reason Trump is running for president this time out is to ensure that he doesn't land in jail, that namely that he can, you know, pardon himself, he can, you know, sort of wipe the slate clean of all the federal charges against him. That's not the case in Georgia. It's a state level prosecution. It's also noteworthy that Georgia, I think, is one of two states in which the governor does not have pardon power. So he could not lean on Brian Kemp, who is trying to be a good, you know, loyal soldier in the MAGA cause to pardon him. There's a 5-person board that does pardons, and that's going to be a pretty difficult needle for someone like Trump to thread. And you know, it's also the case, because it's a RICO prosecution with all of these defendants, you're gonna have many, it's gonna be like a more conventional DA prosecution, where you're gonna try to get people to flip under threat of serious jail time. So you know, we're already seeing Mark Meadows like frantically whirling around trying to get his case, you know, reclassified as a federal case, which has already been a request that's already been struck down. There's just going to be a lot of activity around, you know, these other apparatchiks in the Trump world who would prefer not to be behind bars. So it's going to be, yeah, I think the potential both for long-term serious consequences for Trump personally are far greater, and the potential for getting, you know, I've always said, like, I, you know, how much corroboration do we need? Like, this is also a case where Donald Trump is literally on tape trying to get Brad Raffensperger to, quote, find him 12,000 votes. This does not seem like, you know, a head scratcher from any, you know, for any competent prosecutor to proceed with. So yeah, we'll see. You know, obviously the big caveat here is that, you know, Republicans are fond of saying there's a two-tier justice system, and they're right, but it's not the two-tier justice system they imagine. It's a two-tier justice system that benefits people like Donald Trump, who are immensely wealthy and powerful. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, and in particular, Trump's case, even beyond being a very wealthy person, he's already been allowed to get away with a lot more than any other person facing these charges, just in terms of like witness tampering, you know, like threats.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he should be in jail right now on those grounds alone. He should have been led away in leg irons on January 7th, but that's a whole other
in this case, yeah, justice is grinding extremely slowly and imperfectly, but there's something, there's actually movement happening, and it's gonna the whole combination that we're seeing of Trump as the front runner, because like all these indictments just make his base love him all the more. Combined with the justice system working. I mean, we're really in uncharted territory here. If one were a nihilist, one would almost like the prospect of President Trump serving his presidency not in the White House but from jail.
Sort of like Paul Sorvino and Goodfellas, right?
That's right. Yeah, but anyways, we will continue to watch what happens and see what happens. And you can read Chris's writing in The Nation, where this podcast is also carried. Once again, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Gene. Always a pleasure.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.